You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation, brought to you by Go Wild. Now, as we all know, Go Wild is one of the fastest growing and most popular social media apps, specifically for outdoorsmen, hunting, fishing, and so forth and so on. But recently, they have announced a partnership with Garmin Connect IQ app. Now, what this does, this is like an integration between both platforms. The Go Wild community members will have the ability to track and share robust digital stories ranging from automated archery shot counts, miles hiked, you know, whatever you do throughout the hunt, like scout, put up your tree stand. And this is the cool thing, biometric data collecting. Now, what that is let's say it's your heart rate. And it will track your heart rate, everything from when you see the big buck, as the big buck gets closer and closer, your heart rate starts to go up, you draw back, you shoot the deer, and then the deer runs away. And the app records all that, and you're able to see what your heart rate is throughout this entire process. And I think that's really cool, along with all the other benefits and features of Go Wild, like tracking and documenting your hunt. So go to the website, timetogowild.com, or you can download the Go Wild app wherever you download your apps. So get outside. It's time to go wild.
Thanks for listening to the Backcountry Rookies podcast, brought to you by Elk 101's University of Elk Hunting. The University of Elk Hunting is your one-stop shop for elk hunting education. The course is built with 17 modules, broke down into 38 chapters that cover everything from planning an elk hunt to packing an elk out of the woods, and every tip, tactic, strategy, and situation in between. You owe it to yourself to invest in the most lethal weapon in the elk woods, and that is you, the hunter. Visit elk101.com and save 20% off the price of the course by using the code ROOKIES and start preparing for your elk hunt. What'd you think of that intro, Corey?
I like it.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
I like it too. I like it too. I'm really happy to be able to put the Backcountry Rookies and Elk 101, University of Elk Hunting, together in the same intro. I'm super excited about that.
I am too.
So for all the listeners, today I've got Corey Jacobson on, and I brought him on so we could announce that Corey sponsored the Backcountry Rookies podcast, and then we're just going to talk a little bit about Corey's season that he had last year in 2018, and we have a couple topics that we wanted to touch on that I thought it'd be nice to bring to the listeners. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Corey and let him talk a little bit about what drew him to the Backcountry Rookies podcast and what it was that he liked about it in order to sponsor it. So, Corey, welcome to the show. And
yeah, no, thanks for having me on. And yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, there's sometimes two organizations, two companies, two people, two brands, however you want to look at it, that just have a good fit. And as I was looking for places that we could partner up for 2019 that would make sense and have some good crossover, I think what you're doing with Backcountry Rookies is a perfect fit for what we do with Elk 101 and specifically with the University of Elk Hunting. And, you know, we obviously with the University of Elk Hunting, I think it branches out, and anybody who has any experience level in elk hunting, whether you've never been or whether you've been going for 30 years, there's something there for you. But ideally, you know, the University of Elk Hunting, the online course, is designed for those who are excited to start on that venture. And I think it's, you know, really similar with what your platform is with Backcountry Rookies. You know, just provide confidence in the tools and resources they need to be able to take that first step and make their dream of whether it's backcountry, whether it's elk hunting, whatever it is, just take that step to turn their dream into a reality. So it's a perfect fit, and I'm super excited for the opportunity to work together this year.
Yeah, I am too, most definitely. And I will totally agree that there's a ton of information in that University of Elk Hunting. I went through the program last year after we had you on the first time, which reminds me, for anybody that's listening, in today's show, we're not really going to talk about University of Elk Hunting too much because Corey and I talked about that in last year's show. So I would invite you to refer back to that show and listen to it. And if I remember right, we did about an hour and 20 minutes that was dedicated to some of the chapters or the modules that are part of University of Elk Hunting. So go back and check that out. But a lot of that information that I took from University of Elk Hunting, I was able to put into practice in my 2018 season in Colorado. And although I wasn't able to put something on the ground last year, every day that we were hunting, we were in or around or had elk near us or calling to us. And we just, sometimes you just can't win them, you know, swirling winds. And there's a ton of factors that when you're on the ground, there's a ton of factors that you can't control. And every day it was something new. But that program, when we followed it, it put us in or around elk. I think it was 5 of the 7 days that we were out there. So quality program, check it out. Like I said, we don't want to beat it up too much since there's already a whole program about it. But what I brought Corey on here today too was to talk about, most people are probably familiar with a series that Elk 101 put out last year, and that was Destination Elk. And it's a fantastic series, and I think you guys told an awesome story throughout that whole series. But I kind of wanted to get behind the scenes a little bit and learn or see if there was any funny stories that you might be able to tell that people didn't get to see, that just didn't make it into the final cut. So you got any crazy wild stories for us, Corey?
I think there's always wild and crazy stories when you're elk hunting with us. But this was a kind of a first for us this year. We've always done films in the past. And so we go out for 7 or 8 days and we capture footage, and we usually don't have a storyline until after the hunt. You know, there's usually something that comes up that we don't go out with anything scripted or anything for the hunt. We just go out and capture it, and then we get back and we're like, man, that was a really tough hunt. We had to deal with adverse weather or something. That becomes kind of the focus of the film. And so a ton of stuff gets cut out. You know, there's always funny banter, especially, you know, between when Dirk's there, he always brings a level of humor. There's always things that just don't make it into a film because you take 7 or 8 days of footage and cut it down to 15 or 18 minutes. So this year for us, we were able to give a lot more behind the scenes look in the day by day film and be able to take people, you know, into camp with us and into the tent or into the tent trailer. And so it was really cool because we got to really bring people with us on the hunt. And, you know, we're getting up early in the morning, we're groggy, they're able to see that, we're driving to the hunt, and opening day in Oregon, there's people everywhere. And so they got to share in that frustration with us as we, you know, get to the trailhead and turn around and go back out to the end of the next road and back and forth. And so there wasn't a whole lot that was noteworthy that we weren't able to show just because we didn't have to cut anything out. There was no time restrictions. I think some of our daily videos were almost an hour long or over an hour long. And when we started, we were thinking 20 minutes, 25 minutes max. But once you get in there and realize, hey, people are, even if we aren't elk hunting necessarily, we aren't in the woods hearing elk bugling, there's still things that can be learned. There's still opportunities to allow people a little glimpse into our personalities that they might not get from film and other things that we've done. So it definitely, it was different. It was challenging for us because we had to be on point at all times and not acting, just knowing that, hey, be yourself, but there's a camera going. And, you know, if you're going to pick your nose over there, it might get captured and it might get put in there. And that's just the way it is. So a lot of what we experienced, the highs, the lows, the drama, all of that, we were able to show. But there's always just things that either don't get captured on camera or that just don't make the cut because of the day. You know, the day that David Brinker stuck the broadhead in his leg and we were, you know, it was a tense situation. I think you can see that in that day's film, but everybody said, oh, I can't believe how calm you guys were. And I think we were just all scared out of our minds and, you know, knew that we had to keep calm because if one of us lost it, we probably all would. But I think the part of that day that didn't really get reflected in the series was just that sigh of relief after you realize everything's okay. The adrenaline doesn't really hit you. And it was hours and hours later, you know, Brinker's at the hospital. Donnie and I are back at the truck. We got to ride back around. It was, I don't remember, 20 some miles around on the road to get back up to where we had dropped in from. And we got back there and just sat down for a minute and collected ourselves. And it was, you don't realize how exhausting going through that kind of a tense situation really is physically and mentally. And that was something I don't think that we captured or showed that well. It was just us sitting there and kind of taking that deep breath and almost feeling like, what do we do now? You know, do we go hunting? Or is, you know, the mood was kind of somber and didn't seem right to go hunting with Brinker going to the hospital. But I think, you know, it just allowed us to kind of realize, hey, everything's okay. He's going to be just fine. It's not even an issue anymore, but also reflect on what had happened and then put that behind us and change our mindset and go hunting, which, you know, I think that in itself is an important lesson, whether it's your hunting buddy sticking a broadhead through his leg or whether it's bad weather or predators or a mass of other hunters, whatever the hardship is, you've got to be able to readjust from that and reset and get back after it with a positive attitude. And that night, you know, it was really the first night we got in on elk and had a really good calling sequence with a bull. So it was a good experience there. Donnie's humor, and I think that was one of the other cool things about this season, was being able to allow people to see personalities more. And especially Donnie's, because Donnie is just, he is the most giving person. He is always the first one that starts setting up camp. He's always the first one to jump in and just do things. But he's got a quirky sense of humor. It's kind of a dry sense of humor at times, but it's different. And he's always been so shy around the camera that he never brings that out. Nobody ever gets to experience it. And so this year, I think people got to experience that a little bit, his wit and humor. But some of the things they didn't get to experience was he had basically a dad joke of the day for us every day, just rattling off these corny dad jokes. And I think we only captured one of them on video because it's usually when we're driving, you know, at 4:30 in the morning, and he would just rattle it off before John, the camera guy, was ready or had the camera on. So we didn't capture a lot of that, but I think we're going to make that a part of the daily series in 2019, is making sure that Donnie waits until we have the camera running to drop his humor.
Yeah. You're not allowed to talk until the camera's turned on in the morning. Right. Yeah. He does seem like a funny guy. I've seen him interviewed and then throughout the series, and I'm sure he's hilarious. You wouldn't hunt with him if there wasn't humor there, right?
Nope. Oh, you've got to have humor. Yeah.
Nobody wants to just sit around camp and look at each other and, you know, there's got to be jokes and laughter and all that stuff. So that's good. Yep. Speaking of, how did you get to be known as the Michael Jordan of calling?
Who told you that?
Yeah, maybe I did a little research.
Yeah.
I might have reached out to some people that you know for some tidbits.
You know, we've done a lot for a long time between films and seminars and just being involved with Elk 101. It gives me a chance to meet a lot of people for a long time. And so with platforms like social media and YouTube, you feel like you know people and you're able to connect with them. And when you see them, it's almost like you're seeing a long lost friend. And I'm a huge proponent of secrecy when it comes to hunting areas and not sharing hunting areas. If somebody takes me into their spot, I don't ever go back. I don't ask to go back unless I'm invited. They're just hunting area. A good hunting area is kind of a sacred thing, and I'm very respectful of that. And that combination of two things always makes me a little uncomfortable when I go to somebody else's area. So we were invited to hunt in Oregon with David Brinker. And of course he got hurt. And so he had a good buddy, Brent, that was over there that really stepped up and he took us to his prime areas. And one of the days we were driving up the road and we pulled over alongside the road to wait for, I think Brinker was behind us at that point. And while we're sitting there, a truck came down. And so I try to park my truck. I mean, my license plate on the front of my truck is broken, and I leave it that way just so nobody can see it. And I'll back my truck into the spot, and that way they don't see the license plate. But I do have a couple stickers on my back window. But anyway, this truck's coming down the road, and it's not a main road by any means. And I just kind of ducked my head down and looked the other direction and made it look like we were, either just getting to the truck or just leaving. And they go by, and about 30 seconds later, I look in the rearview mirror, and they're pulling in behind us in this spot. And it's not a trailhead where, two cars are going to park and both people are going to get out and go hunting. And they're jumping out of the back of the truck, and one of them has his bow. And I just thought, that is incredibly rude that we're parked here. We're here waiting for somebody, and they're just going to grab their bows and jump in front of us and head up the mountain. And, I'm telling Donnie and John, I'm like, man, these guys are, that's not how we do it where I'm from. And they come up to the window, and so Donnie rolls his window down, and the one guy starts freaking out, and he's like, I told you it's him. I told you it's him. And evidently they recognized us in the truck when they drove by. And so they were, giggling like little girls at a Justin Bieber concert. And the one said, well, as they were walking away, we took time and chatted with them, and they were excited. We were hunting the same area they were. And as they turned around and went back to their truck, Brinker had pulled up at that time, and he was getting out, and they walked by and like, do you know who that guy is up there? And he's like, yeah, I'm hunting with him. Like, oh my gosh, he's the Michael Jordan of elk hunting. And so that's all I heard about the entire rest of that trip was, hey, Michael, what do you think? Full court press? Or, it turned into a Michael Jordan joke fest, and I was the butt of it for the most part.
That's a good story. I'm glad I reached out and did a little background research for that question. So that is funny.
There's only two people in the world that that know about that, so I'll be sure and thank both of them. And
yeah,
I'm sure one of them will fess up.
Yeah. I said, should I know that information? Should I ask that question? he'll probably be okay with it.
I am. I just, I'm just a regular guy, and so any kind of attention like that, I'm kind of awkward around it and don't know how to take it. So they had fun with that. They like making me uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's all in fun, I'm sure, and it makes for a good elk camp, at least.
Totally.
Yeah. Wasn't there, did I see somewhere too where somebody had put this wasn't Destination Elk, this might have been a year before, somebody put a big sticker on your window that said you call too much or something like that?
So we do have a very aggressive style of calling, and when we don't have an elk located, that's how I locate them. So we get on a ridge and we'll just cover a lot of country, and we do bugle a lot. And in my opinion and experience, it's very effective. And other people don't feel that way. They think more hunters educating the elk, and that's why the elk are call shy. And anyway, we were hunting a drainage here in Idaho. It's been several years ago, I think 2013. And there was a hunter up on the ridge. So there's a four-wheeler trail that comes up on the ridge. And we heard the four-wheeler up there and heard it shut off and didn't hear any bugling or anything. And we're at least 3/4 mile away, and we're heading in the opposite direction, so we weren't even concerned. But we got back to the truck that night around dark, and there's a note just from a notepad on my windshield in the windshield wiper. And I'm thinking, one of my buddies drove by and saw my truck here and recognized it. But it was most likely our friend with the four-wheeler from up on the ridge, and he'd left a note, and it said, if you were up this drainage this morning, you bugle way too much. And that's kind of been a standing joke for us that anytime we're a car drives by, it's like, oh, we're putting another note on the windshield. But we've definitely played that one quite a few times. And then this year when we're in Wyoming, we do have another buddy who knows where we hunt up there, and he knew we were going to be there. And we got back one day, and he'd left a note on my truck, and it said, if you were hunting up here, you didn't bugle enough, or some play on the same note that we got.
That's funny. Has that ever been a case where you don't bugle enough?
No.
No, I didn't.
You can never bugle enough.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's funny. I know we did that. I think it's interesting because they're starting to become like hunting tactics, and people refer to those tactics as like the Corey Jacobson method, and that's the find your drainage and hammer it and bugle it. And then there's the Cat Road Shuffle, and that's becoming like the born and raised guys style of, you know, hey, let's go hunt bro style. And it's the Cat Road Shuffle, right, where guys are just walking the roads and calling off the road. So it's almost, yep. Yeah. So you're identified with the hunting style. How about that?
As long as it's aggressive and successful, I'm okay with it. If it becomes unsuccessful or, I don't know, there's just something about elk hunting that I think the more aggressive you take it, the more thrilling it becomes. And it just, you know, hunting elk is hunting elk. There's nothing wrong with any method of hunting elk. And it's all fun and good, but man, there's just something about calling elk that gets in your blood and it just haunts you 11 months out of the year.
So I didn't really get a chance to call too much. We, at the last year when we went to Colorado, with the, I don't know, toward the last minute there before we went, I ended up meeting up with a friend of a friend who was from Colorado. And he went with us, and he had a ton of experience calling, and you know, just he's a very experienced elk hunter. So he was pretty much our call guy. So I didn't get to do it too much, but I don't know. This year, I'm excited for it. I know my truck certainly gets called out a lot when I'm driving to work, and my windshield my windshield's probably tired of hearing bugle calls or terrible bugle calls rather. But anyway,
no, and that's, you know, you brought up a point there that you hunted with a friend of a friend, and it's so hard because we have our style of elk hunting and we've been elk hunting a long time. And I'm, you know, I think if you talk to Dirk or Donnie, either one, they're both going to say I'm pretty set in my ways. They might say I'm really set in my ways. And I think I am, especially when it comes to elk hunting. It's just, we've found a way that works and we just go after it. But hunting in Oregon this year, you know, especially when Brinker wasn't there and we're hunting with Brent, I had never met Brent before. I didn't know him at all. And he's super quiet. He wouldn't even stand in front of the camera. If we turned the camera on, he'd walk behind it. And just really, he was uncomfortable with what we were doing, which made me uncomfortable with what I was doing. And, you know, I didn't want to go into his area and just start hammering it like I do areas that I hunt, as far as with calls and everything. And so, you know, I'm being really timid and just a couple cow calls here. And we got back to camp the first night, and I think it was John, our camera guy. He said, I don't think I have ever heard you bugle so little. And it, you know, it kind of dawned on me that I was completely changing my calling style. It was early season. It was full moon, some of those factors, but I was super timid to really unleash the calls in somebody else's area, especially with them there. And he was totally devoted to helping us. And he said, you know, do your thing. But at the same time, I think in the back of my mind, I know that my thing is not the thing for everybody. And it might be taken as too aggressive. But within 2 or 3 days, we'd talked about it. And I had escalated my aggression in calling. And he was towards the end of the hunt, he's like, well, that's how I hunt. And so it worked out good. But those first few days are definitely trying to feel it out in somebody else's area and being their guest. I didn't want to just jump right into full threat level bugling. And
say, why didn't you tell me that on the first day? We could have been bugling this whole time.
No, it was awesome. Having him there, it got us into elk from the gate, which I realized we don't always have that opportunity or that luxury of having somebody that knows the area that can take you right in. And opening morning, 200 yards from the truck, we had a bull elk in front of us in, you know, I'd never hunted Roosevelt elk before. So that was a first. I had never been in this area before. And it was still too early to even shoot. And we have a bull elk in front of us. So it definitely is an advantage to hunt with somebody that knows the area.
Hmm. Nice. So real quick, and then we'll move on to another topic, but Oregon being completely new to you, was there any sort of lessons learned or new tactics that you had to try going out there? Or were you pretty much, aside from the calling that you already mentioned, or were you pretty much just normal like you would hunt your Rocky Mountain elk?
You know, and it's that was really what I wanted to experience was, you know, I just want to be able to, if I'm going to talk about elk hunting and teach people everything I know about elk hunting, I think I owe it to them and to myself to educate myself on as many different aspects of elk hunting and as many different situations and even species. So, you know, Roosevelt elk, first time I'd hunted them. And my first introduction to Roosevelt elk hunting was through the Born and Raised DVDs, you know, back 8 years ago, 10 years ago or whatever, and seeing them, and they have a very aggressive style of hunting. And I got to meet them and become really good friends with them. And we've hunted together since. But in talking to them, you know, they'd never hunted Rocky Mountain elk until they went to Wyoming, I think 4 years ago or whenever it was. And so comparing notes with them, they realized, and it helped me understand before I went, that really the same tactics, everything works. It's, you know, they're elk or elk. Roosevelt elk are very aggressive. Some of the challenges and the differences, though, are the terrain. And the terrain really dictates a lot of their habits and how you locate them. You know, a Roosevelt bull will sometimes have a 500-yard radius that he lives in. And that's, it's so thick there that they don't have to get up and move out to be safe. They can go 200 yards and they're in another thicket and they hunker down and they're safe. Whereas you come over, you know, into the Rocky Mountain states where the Rocky Mountain elk are, and I've had elk that we've jumped before, we've spooked, that I've watched them go a mile and a half out across the open and then up into the next patch of timber. And I go into that patch of timber the next day and they still aren't there. They've continued past there. So just the range that the elk have was one of the real eye-openers for me to see it firsthand, just how thick it really is. And video doesn't portray that story very well, because you can make anything look open for 20 yards. And on video, it's like, oh, they're in an opening. But realistically, for the next 6 miles in every direction, you couldn't even hardly crawl through it. So that was our biggest challenge, and probably the thing that I learned the most was having to adapt calling. With it being that thick, the elk sound like they're farther away than they are, and so a lot of times we'd want to move in on them and we'd step on them because they're really close. Locating elk, you have to be pretty much on top of them before you hear them bugle. And then the other thing was just the weather, and being right on the coast like that, you don't necessarily have mountain thermals like I'm used to, where the thermals every morning when it's cool, they're coming down, and as it warms up, they're going up. There were some days that the wind blew uphill all day just because that was the coastal wind direction for the day. So a couple of those things were the primary lessons I learned. As far as tactics and all of that, I wouldn't change a thing from how I hunt Rocky Mountain elk.
How was the moisture and precipitation and all that stuff when you were in Oregon?
It was wet.
Fair enough.
Both the moisture and the precipitation were wet.
Yeah. Well, generally they are. Right. I guess I could have worded that a little different, but
no, I know what you're asking there. And it was so crazy because it would be clear. Literally, we're leaving camp up, you know, we're camped up higher, and it's clear blue skies, just stars. There's not a cloud in the sky. And then we get down lower elevation closer to the coast, and there's just a bank of fog. And it's thick, thick fog. And you get inside of it, and where we're hunting, we get in the thick brush and the timber and the canopy there, and it sounds like a downpour. There's so much moisture and condensation coming from the fog, landing on the leaves and then dripping out of the trees onto the ground. It sounds like a downpour. It's you're soaked like a downpour. There's water coming down like a downpour, but there's not a cloud in the sky above that fog layer. And so I think every day we dealt with being wet, and we didn't wear rain gear just because it's early enough, it's warm enough. Gaiters were a lifesaver though, and so having a good set of waterproof gaiters to keep our boots dry. We were soaked, but just in the matter of hiking, and then once the fog melts off, we dried out quickly. But it was wet every day.
Just out of curiosity, do you wear synthetic base layers or merino base layers?
I wear synthetic, and you know, it's a Ford Chevy thing. I think there's definitely benefits to merino, but I think there's equal benefits to synthetic. And for me, we have access to be able to either wash our clothes or to be able to take, you know, four sets of base layer shirts or something and wear them on an 8-day hunt. And so after 2 days, synthetics, you know, the scent isn't an issue. If you wear a synthetic base layer for 7 days, it's going to stink. It just holds odor. Whereas a merino doesn't. It's antimicrobial, so it'll kill odor on contact, and so it doesn't stink even after 7 days. The thing about synthetics is they dry so much faster, And for me, if my shirt starts stinking, I'll go down to a creek, rinse it out in the creek, wring it out, and hang it in a tree for 15 minutes, and it's dry enough to put on and go hunt. And so I don't worry about the odor side of it. We don't do a whole lot of, 7 days in the backcountry. We're usually coming out if we do stay overnight for a night or two back in somewhere. We're usually coming out and we'll have a fresh set of base layers. The advantage of Merino is it doesn't stink. And if you get wet, it will keep you warmer as a wet article of clothing compared to cotton or something else that's going to retain moisture. Merino will keep you warmer. But the beauty of synthetic is it doesn't stay wet. And so you don't have to worry about that. It gets your core dry and your core is able to regulate temperature. And so for active hunting and hiking hard, where I have an option to come out at least every other day and switch out a base layer if I need to or rinse it out in the creek, I prefer synthetics.
I was just curious, especially in that super wet type of environment, that I figured you were going to say synthetic, especially for there, just how fast it does dry.
Yeah.
And something that led me to that precipitation question was my buddy that we hunted with, the friend of a friend, he is from Oregon, but we were hunting in Colorado. And at one point in time, it had rained or something the night before pretty heavy, and all the undergrowth and the brush and everything was all wet, and we were soaked. And he was wearing a pair of boots that they leaked real bad, and his feet were just drenched. And the guy, he's taking off his boots and wringing out his socks, and me and the other friend that was with us were like, "Man, we've got extra socks. We can get your feet dry." And he looked at both of us and was like, "I'm from Oregon, man. This is nothing. This doesn't bother me. I hunt in constantly wet."
I can't handle wet feet. That is, I don't care where you're from. Your feet shouldn't be wet. And I don't know how people can do that. John, our camera guy, they were just a lightweight, not even a hiking boot, more of almost a mountain running shoe. And his feet were soaked. And I think it was day five. If you want to see something funny, we had him pull off his boot and his sock and got video of his feet. But they were just white, wrinkled. He had moleskin and leukotape all over his feet, top, bottom, sides, everywhere. And Donnie and I are standing there with completely dry feet, even in Oregon with all that moisture. And obviously the gaiters were a huge part of that. But having good boots that don't leak and keeping our feet dry I can't stand hiking in wet feet.
I can't. It drives me nuts. That's the way Gus's feet were the same way when he took his boots off and socks. They were just all pale and wrinkled, like he'd had them just sitting in a bathtub. Jeez, how are you going to do that? I figured they were just going to be ruined, but he was fine with it. We kept going all day. So anyway, Well, I wanted to move on a little bit, and I know that you've been kind of taking on the wolf challenge up there in Idaho pretty heavy this year. Is that something that's new for you, is the wolf hunting?
Not really new necessarily. I think I have more availability of time and location now. So up until 3 years ago, we were traveling to multiple shows every year, starting in January through about the end of March. And wolf season closes in Idaho the end of March. So I was at shows 5-6 days a week, 6 or 7 times from the beginning of the year to the end of March, and then trying to keep up with work when I'd get back. And so I just really didn't have time to put any effort into it. I'd go out for a day here and a day there. But with wolf hunting, those things move so much that you really have to find them. It takes a couple of days to find them. Then it takes you a couple of days to figure out where they're moving, what they're doing, how they're hunting. And then once you figure that out, then the real challenge of actually hunting them can start. So about a year and a half ago, my family and I moved, and we moved up into the mountains about 2.5 hours north of Boise, and it's wolf central. It really is. We moved up here because we can be close to elk. The schools are better for our kids. It's just, life slowed down. But one of the fringe benefits is there's a wolf pack in just about every drainage up here. And so being able to be up here and, you and I were talking before we started the podcast, I was in my garage, sweeping out my garage on Saturday and heard a wolf howl. And so, just ran in, grabbed my rifle and my daughter, and we took off out after it. And so being that close to them, And having that availability, plus not having shows that are taking me away from home and work so much, it definitely opens up some more time to hunt them. So it's kind of a new thing to be able to hunt wolves the way that you really have to hunt wolves to hope to be successful.
So stepping away from hunting wolves, how about hunting elk in wolf country? Has that changed the way that you hunt elk?
Wolves have changed the way we have to hunt elk. They really have. And, you know, there's some places where there are wolves where elk hunting hasn't changed necessarily. One of the areas in Wyoming we go to is they have a ton of wolves and they still have a lot of elk, and the elk are fairly vocal there. You know, I guess maybe it has changed. I didn't hunt there before there were wolves. So maybe the guys who hunted there, like, you should have seen it 15 years ago, but I know here in Idaho, the area we hunted, and I've been hunting it since 1997, and it was just insane with elk back then in the late 90s. And it was 1995, 96 when the wolves were introduced to Idaho, and it took them a while. You know, I think there were only four pairs or something that were initially dropped off, and so it took them a while to really build up to where they are today. But over that next, I would say, 8 to 10 years, we had incredible elk hunting. The calling was incredible. There were elk in every drainage. You could just pick a spot and go, and you'd be into elk if you hiked hard. And I think it was 2002, 2003, we saw our first wolves, and we thought it was an elk bugle. We heard something out on the ridge, and so we hiked down there and set up, and we're cow calling and hadn't heard anything, and looked over, and there's three black wolves coming through the grass about 60 yards away from us, circling around us. And we actually got video of it and went back, and Fishing Game stopped by our camp a couple days later, and we asked him about it. He's like, "Oh, there's no wolves here." And I said, "Oh, really? We've got some video we want to show you." And so we pulled it out and showed him, and he's like, "Yeah, we actually know about those, and, you know, they've been causing us some problems here, and they're definitely killing elk." And so anyway, throughout the next 10 years or so, it was just carnage on the elk. The elk weren't used to dealing with an apex predator like a wolf. We have mountain lions, we have bears, all of that. But mountain lions and bears will kill an elk, you know, once every 2 weeks type of a thing. A bear does its most damage when the elk are having calves in the spring. Mountain lions do their most damage in the winter, but they eat year round. But they're the kind of hunter, they target one elk, they kill it, they eat it till it's gone. And now there's wolves that are hunting in packs, and the elk, and especially the moose, didn't know how to deal with it. And they took a pretty hard hit as they were adjusting to it. And through that process, they became pretty call shy, just recognizing, hey, every time I bugle, every time I open my mouth, a pack of wolves show up. And it was just kind of a dinner bell for those wolves for the to hear an elk bugle. And so elk are a lot less vocal. They're more call shy. I think in areas like where I live, it takes a lot more to coax them in. When they come in, they're on guard. All of their senses are up, and they're just aware of their surroundings a lot more. It's fun to go to a place like Arizona where there really aren't predators. Yeah, there's a mountain lion down there, and they have the little wolves. I don't even remember what they are, which wolves they have, but I think the Mexican gray wolf or something, which are basically just a big coyote. So it's not the same as what we have. They don't impact the elk herds the same way. And those elk just come in with their guard down. You know, they really do. They just come in. They aren't worried about which way the wind's blowing. They aren't looking for a predator to jump out from behind a tree and get them. And it's completely different level of wariness. And that translates to a completely different level of challenge for hunting elk in a wolf infested area like we have here. And so I think a couple of the things that I noticed that I have to do differently: the elk don't respond nearly as much from nearly as far away. So we have to cover more country and get right on top of the elk sometimes to get a response out of them. They don't bugle back and forth. You know, we used to sit half a mile across the canyon and bugle, and every time we'd bugle, the bull would answer, and we'd do that for 3 hours, and the bull would answer every time. Now they'll bugle once, and maybe 10 minutes later they'll bugle again. But when you get in close and engage that elk, sometimes they'll still, you know, only growl or only chuckle and keep their bugles kind of soft, but they're still, the rut happens. The elk breed, the bulls breed the cows every year. It still happens. It's just changed their vocalization quite a bit in some of these areas. And so we've had to adjust how we find them and how we vocalize with them.
So even during the rut and that pre-rut, do you have to do a lot more spot and stalk then?
You know, I don't. I mean, I think you'd probably be, I wouldn't say more effective, but I think the tables definitely turn so that the elk, you know, being able to call in an elk isn't as easy as it was 20 years ago. And I do attribute it primarily to wolves, because when I go to other states where they don't have wolves, the elk are still very responsive, and it's actually more enjoyable to call them in there. And there will be people that argue and say, oh, it's everybody out there has a call in their mouth and they're running around blowing it and they've educated the elk. And honestly, I don't think from one September to the next, I don't think an elk remembers that there were a bunch of people running around blowing bugles a year ago. I don't think they have that long-term memory. But when they're dealing with surviving from wolves on a day-by-day basis throughout the year, they do retain that. And so I don't think that elk hunting, yeah, sure, by the end of September, the elk are call shy because of human pressure for that month. But I don't think they carry it over to the next September. I really think that it's very much pressure from predators that drives them to be call shy from year to year in those same areas. So yeah, we change. I don't change tactics necessarily. I change strategies within the same tactic. So we cover a lot more country. We know we're walking by elk that aren't bugling. I'm just trying to find one that is bugling. And when we get them, sometimes I realize it's going to take us going to them and being a little bit more stealthy, getting in the perfect setup where the elk feels like he's safe coming into it before he commits to coming in. And there's just a couple other things, you know, that we kind of have to make sure we're aware of because of the presence of wolves in the area.
And do you carry a sidearm when you hunt?
Not for wolves. I don't think there's any threat. There's been one documented case of a wolf attack, I think, in Canada a while back. Outside of that, you know, there maybe in Alaska there was one documented at some point. But with as many wolves as there are between Canada, Alaska, and the lower 48, to have so few attacks, it's just so incredibly rare that that doesn't even cross my mind. I don't worry about it. I don't dwell on it. And I don't take any precaution. I think just having my bow gives me enough confidence that I've got a weapon and not too concerned. When we hunt grizzly country, completely another, you know, that's a different story altogether. But for wolves, there's really no concern about their presence or our security in their presence.
That's cool. I like good perspective. I mean, you're out there in it, so you know how to deal with it and you've seen it, and that's good information to get.
Yeah, no, it's definitely eerie when you know, you're standing there in dark timber or right at dark and you have a 3-mile hike out and a pack of wolves starts howling 200 yards from you. It makes you wish you had a pistol sometimes, but we've never had any kind of encounter. They're curious sometimes. Until we had a hunting season 2 or 3 years ago, up until that point, they definitely didn't have a lot of fear of humans. And so that caused some, you know, not, I wouldn't even call them an encounter, but there is, now everybody has a story. I'm sure a lot of people have a story of a wolf that followed them back or, you know, threatened them or whatever. And they come into elk calls. I've had people that call them into 6 yards and the wolf sits there and just looks at them like it's not scared of them at all. And so they're definitely scary situations. But as far as safety goes, I don't think that's a concern.
I think if a wolf got within 6 yards of me, I'd look like a cartoon with a dust trail puffing out of the back. You know, I'd be long gone.
Yeah.
Anyway, so one other thing that I wanted to talk about today, while we're chatting, was your hunt of a lifetime. And not necessarily the hunt. I mean, we can talk about your hunt that you did if you wanted to. But I wanted to talk about that organization, because I know it's not just an Idaho thing. It's a nationwide thing. Is it worldwide? I don't even know if it's a nationwide.
I don't know if it's world. I know nationwide. I think they get up into Canada too. So maybe North America.
Okay. Yeah, I was just kind of curious of the structure of how the company works and how they identify their the people that are going to get to go on the hunts, and then how they pick the hunters that are taking people out, that sort of stuff.
For sure. So it's Hunt of a Lifetime. That's the name of the organization. And I don't know what year they started. They're based out of Pennsylvania. And the lady who started it, her name's Tina, and I've talked to her a few times on the phone and by email and everything. So they basically, that's the headquarters of Hunt of a Lifetime. And then they have chapters throughout several states, and each chapter kind of organizes under the headquarters command, I guess, organizes opportunities to provide hunts for youth who have life-threatening illnesses. So the way it started is Tina actually had a son, and his name was Matt, and he had cancer, and she contacted one of the organizations who grants wishes to children in those situations and just said, hey, my son's dream is to go on a hunt. I think it was a moose hunt. And they said, well, we don't do hunting. We don't support hunting, and we aren't able to provide those wishes to children. And she said his dream wasn't to go to Disneyland or to meet a famous celebrity or anything. He just wanted to go hunting. That was his desire. And so she on her own just kind of went out and started calling people and saying, hey, my son wants to go moose hunting. He has cancer. Is there anything we can do? We don't have $10,000 to pay for him to go on a moose hunt. And there's an outfit, I think it might have been in Canada, that stepped up and said, absolutely, let's do this. And so through that experience, her son was able to go on a moose hunt and shoot a moose. And I think it was within the year, I think 6 months after he went hunting, he ended up passing away from cancer. And so through that experience, Tina started the Hunt of a Lifetime organization just to provide for those children who their dream is to go on a hunt, whether it's duck hunting or turkey hunting or white-tailed deer. I mean, if you have a dream to hunt or fish, I think the Hunt of a Lifetime is open to trying to secure that and make it happen. And as you can imagine, there's a huge demand for families that are in these situations to want to provide that for their children. So I don't know the total process. I know that there's an application that families can apply, and I know that there has to be a doctor's note, I think, that says, yes, they have a life-threatening illness. And then from there, they just kind of try to match up what the child's wish is, what their dream hunt is, with states that offer that they have a chapter in. And so for us, the state of Idaho is phenomenal when it comes to providing opportunity for youth, for recruitment of new hunters. And another cool thing that they do is they offer 5 tags for organizations, for nonprofit organizations who provide tags to or hunt opportunities to these youth with life-threatening illnesses. And so in Idaho, the Hunt of a Lifetime chapter, we've been able to usually get pretty much as many of those tags, of those 5 tags, as we need. And I think the most we've taken out in a year is 4 youth. And I say we, meaning the whole state chapter, not our group. We take out just 1 a year. But we got involved. Donnie got us involved, I think, 4 years ago, and went out to the camp with the group from Idaho. And he came back and said, it's life-changing. You've got to do it. I was already committed to doing something else that week and wasn't able to go. But he just kept talking about it. It's not just a normal hunt. It's life-changing. We have to do more. And so I got involved and just said, hey, we've got an organization, Elk 101. We've got pro staff that would love to be involved. They're all very giving guys. And we can facilitate a hunt if you can find a hunter. And it was, an easy thing to do. So they ended up finding a hunter for us. We set up an Elk 101 camp for Hunt of a Lifetime and had just an incredible time. And it was life-changing, just in the way that it opened my eyes to how blessed we are and how much we really take for granted. And to be able to go and do something that we love to do, for us, it's recreation. It's, somebody calls us and says, hey, you can go hunt elk in a tremendous unit, and you don't get the tag, but you get to go out and call and be a part of it, all of that. I think most of us would jump on that, and to take it to a whole new level where here's somebody who, some of these youth, we had one that was 8 years old that came out that was battling leukemia. This year, Jeff had overcome leukemia, and he was in remission, and he was 17, and he was healthy and strong at the time. There's others that have come out that, you know, their outlook after the hunt wasn't as good. And so we just, to be able to see them and to know that we are doing something for them that we take for granted, that it's really easy, but for them, it's their lifelong dream. And to see the joy it brings them, to see how the dad and the son, or the parents and the child, interact on that, and the joy it brings them and the opportunity it gives them to kind of forget the struggles they've been going through and that they're currently going through sometimes. It's, we'll be involved as long as they let us. That's just it. It's usually at the end of our elk season, after we've had a rough season, we're beat up physically, sometimes mentally, and to go out and do that, it's really a recharge and reminds us why we do it and how blessed we are to do what we do.
Sounds pretty awesome to be involved in. I know when I was growing up, my dad was involved in something similar, and it was called, I believe it was called Hunters Helping Hunters, and it was very similar. I remember he had taken a guy out that was in a wheelchair and couldn't really get out. This was back in Indiana, so he couldn't get up in a tree stand, and they built a blind for him, you know, and they got him out there and got him where he needed to go. And I'm pretty sure he got a deer, you know. I mean, it was just a really, really awesome experience. And my dad said exactly the same thing too. It was just probably the most fulfilling hunt that he's ever been on, you know, was that one, as opposed to filling any tag that he ever filled. Really cool stuff. I always think that kind of stuff is really neat when hunters get out and do that and share what they know and help other hunters. So,
yeah, and it takes a big group to put it on, you know, just the planning side of it, the fundraising side of it, the, you know, the just the day-to-day, making sure we have an extra tent and cots and sleeping bags and all of that planning that goes into it. And then on the ground, you know, there's several times that these youth come out and they're physically not able to hike in elk country. And it's not, you know, super rugged elk country where we go, but it's, you know, there's mountains. And there's often times that we end up carrying the child piggyback with us throughout the day. And so, you know, having four or five guys there to shift back and forth and share that load sometimes is it's required. And so to be able to get a group of guys that are just selfless like that and willing to sacrifice, any one of them who are at camp could have went and bought a tag and be out hunting for themselves. And they give that up. They take vacation time to be there and be involved. And I think it goes to show, number one, how awesome those guys are, but number two, how awesome it is to be involved with something like this, that they're willing to sacrifice that week.
That's really cool. Really cool. Really neat organization.
It is.
I guess we'll start wrapping it up right there, Corey. I just wanted to ask before we shut it down if you had any parting thoughts or any final thoughts that you wanted to share before we get out of here.
You know, I didn't prepare anything, but the first thing that comes to mind is it's application season for elk hunting. You know, Wyoming's in January, Arizona and Utah coming up. You know, all the states throughout the West have applications for elk hunting. And obviously there are some units and some states that allow over-the-counter. You can just show up and buy a tag. But it's, you know, whatever is holding people back from going elk hunting, make a plan and overcome that. If that's applying for tags, now's the time to do it. If it's financial, I say this with complete understanding that money doesn't grow on a tree, but it's not as expensive as most people think to go elk hunting. And when I say that, you know, I'm talking $1,200 to $1,500. I think you can go on an elk hunt and have a real chance at success if you're armed with the knowledge that you need to be successful. Now, obviously somebody coming from non-elk country, going into elk country and just showing up and buying a tag and going out and trying to find elk for the first time and hunt elk, yeah, your chances of success probably aren't going to be as high, but the experiences and the adventure of hunting elk, if it's on your bucket list, don't wait until you're too old. Do it now, plan it now. And, you know, cut out your morning coffee for a year and you'll save enough money to go on an elk hunt by next season. Whatever it takes, just make that plan and make that commitment to do it, because it's a once in a lifetime experience that you'll need to experience much more than once in a lifetime.
Yeah. Let's keep going back. Yeah. So now that people are almost done with this particular episode, so thanks for listening to this one, but I'll refer you to Elk Talk Podcast if you haven't already listened to it. this week, Corey and Randy Newberg released an episode called Get Your Elk Tag for 2019. I just got done listening to that today, and there's a ton of good information in that podcast. When you're talking about the tag season and application season that you guys cover, I think in that episode, that was the one you cover every state, I think, right? Do you remember?
We did. So we just gave a real brief overview of kind of the pros and cons of each of the elk states. Talked about kind of our strategies a little bit for how we can make sure we're getting tags every year. And somebody like Randy, you know, Randy goes on, I think, 13 or 14 hunts every season through his platforms and his TV show. So he has to have tags. And so he's very vested in that application process. For me, I want to make sure that I've got several different strategies and I implement them through the application process every year. But we're blessed because I can buy 2 elk tags here in Idaho. And so it's not as critical for me, but it's still pretty darn important to me to stay on top of that and make sure. I love just going to new states and branching out and having new adventures and unknown adventures and all of that. So, yeah, in that podcast, we touched each state, our strategies, but then we're also releasing a podcast on each state specifically, breaking down in detail their draw process, their tag allocation, our strategy in that state, the pros and cons of that state. So a lot of good stuff this time of year for sure on applying for elk tags in the West.
Yeah, so I wanted to just summarize that episode really quick. And Corey and Randy, they both very, very, they say, stay out of Idaho and Colorado. It's going to be terrible hunting. So just to summarize, stay out of Idaho, stay out of Colorado.
Did we say that?
Maybe I said that. Maybe that was me making that up. I don't know. But yeah, I'm looking forward. I'm excited to get your Arizona episode when that comes out, because I'm trying to. I got a couple points out there, and I'm asking some buddies back in Arizona, what do I do with 2 points? Do I do anything, or do I put in, you know, go for it all and just? I don't want to sit on them until I've got 10 or 15. I think I'm just going to apply for something really, really difficult, and then something not so difficult. And if I draw one, great. If not, then they roll over till next year, so it's not a big deal.
Yep. And that's a beauty. I was actually just out on Go Hunt this morning looking at my points and what my opportunities are. And I think people are sometimes surprised to see how much opportunity there really is, even in some of these states that it seems like, you know, Arizona, you think that's the land of monster elk and they don't have any over-the-counter tags. And it takes 15 to 20 years to draw a decent quality archery rut tag. But if you know where to look and what to look for, there's definitely opportunity where you can draw a tag every other year in Arizona. And that's, I think people are surprised to hear that.
I'm going to give it a try. We'll see. If not, then like I said, there's always next year and then maybe the year after that.
Totally.
Yeah. So anyway, Corey, you want to leave your contact website stuff real quick and then we'll call it a show.
Yeah. Yeah, they can follow us on Instagram at Elk101. I've also got my personal Instagram page there. It's just coreyjacobson.elk101. And then the website is elk101.com. And on there, you can find all the information regarding the University of Elk Hunting online course. And if you go to your website, Chad, there's a banner on there with a pretty awesome promo code they can use. Just use the code ROOKIES. If you sign up for the online course, it's going to save you 20%. And yeah, that's it. We try to keep it pretty simple.
Yep. So use that code. Rookie saves you 20%. I think that's a smoking deal on that, on the University of Elk Hunting course. There's a ton of information in there and you just can't go wrong. So anyway, Corey, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate you coming on, first of all, and then, well, second of all, actually, first of all, I appreciate you sponsoring the show and getting behind us and believing in the show. So thanks a lot.
Likewise. No, thank you. We're super excited and just excited to share our message and our passion for elk hunting with as many people as we can. And honestly, the more people we can get into elk hunting, Will Primo summed it up best. I was interviewing him and spent some time with him a couple years ago. And he said, if you teach somebody to love something, they're going to protect it. And I think that at the end of the day, that's really what our mission is just to get people excited about elk hunting, to keep them engaged in elk hunting, and knowing that if they love elk hunting, they're going to help us protect elk so that years from now, our children and grandchildren are going to be able to share this passion. We're going to be able to pass it on to them and know that they have places to hunt and elk to hunt.
Well said. Well, thanks, Corey. Oh, I'm sorry, one more thing. So Elk Corey and Elk 101 have donated a couple of the University of Elk Hunting subscriptions and some bugle and call packages and things that we're going to be doing a giveaway on. So look for those coming up. Pretty sure February. I've got one coming up next month, so be on the lookout for that. You'll start seeing it popping up on Instagram and kind of bouncing around a little bit. So keep that in mind. Those are coming up. And thanks for donating those, Corey.
Totally. Happy to. Yep.
All right. Thanks for coming on, and we'll chat again soon, I hope.
Sounds great. Thanks, Chad.
And that's a wrap on that show. Thanks to Corey for coming on, and I think we got a lot of good stuff to come this year, partnering up with Elk 101, so I'm really, really looking forward to it. I wanted to say thank you to Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network for having us on and having us be part of the podcast network. And I know on the last show I said that I was going to have Kyle Camp from Valley to Peak Nutrition, but I wanted to get Corey on after he got in touch with me and we decided to do the sponsorship thing. So actually the next show will be Kyle Camp from Valley to Peak Nutrition. And I wanted to talk just very briefly about some upcoming giveaways that we have going on. So as I mentioned in the podcast there, University of Elk Hunting is going to be donating a couple of the subscriptions for the course, as well as some calls and bugle tubes and some other stuff like that from them. I've got an OnX premium membership that I'm going to be giving away. I have an FHF bino harness with a Razco holster. It's a whole kind of setup that goes together. It's really cool. Check those guys out. FHF and Razco gear. And then I've got some stuff from MSR. I've got a Pocket Rocket 2 and a Trail Base water filter system that we're going to give away. And then some stuff from Black Diamond also. So a Black Diamond spot and then a set of trekking poles, the Trail Ergo trek poles. So a lot of good stuff coming up on giveaways for this year. I also have a bowstring that I'm giving away. There's going to be a knife coming up. That bowstring is from JBK Bowstrings, and the knife is from Artemis Knife Works. So check all those guys out. And with that, we will be back next week. Thanks for tuning in, and listen next week to Valley to Peak Nutrition.